Hello, and thank you for listening to the FlixWise podcast. I'm your host and friend of the felines, Lady P. No relation to Master P. And currently besotted with fruit brandy is our guest and co-producer, Mr. Martin Kessler.
Hello.
It's okay, Martin. We all cope in our own way. And I'm very pleased to announce that our other guest has trudged his way through the muck of life's indignities just so he could be here today. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome back to the show, Mr. Tad Chamberlain.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
On today's episode, we have a whale of a movie, the cinematic equivalent of Moby Dick, the movie you'll eventually sit down and watch one of these days, just as soon as you have the time. It's the 36th movie on the Sight and Sound list, Bellatar's 1994 behemoth, Satan Tango. Yep. All three of us on this panel have seen Tar's 7.5-hour meditation on existential misery. We're going to talk about the film, its structure, its themes, the performances, and yes, the long takes. Because this film is 7.5 hours, I want to make sure we allocate enough time to get into the analysis, so I'm going to forego a second topic, but rest assured, we will still close things out with some final notes of positivity. I have a feeling we're going to need it. Also, please do stick around through the end credits because I have a big announcement to make. So, gentlemen, are we ready?
I'm ready. I'm wearing my Bellatar t-shirt and I'm ready to go.
It's true. I'm going to have to take a picture of that. All right. Then, shall we dance?
That might have been, if we were going to do a second movie, that might have been a good movie.
Shall we dance?
Be completely the opposite.
Oh, a little Fred Astaire action.
There's roughly the same amount of dancing in both films. So.
Yes, that's probably true. Okay, here is a brief summary of the plot of Satan Tango, or at least the plot as I understand it.
I'm going to go for a bathroom break. I'll be back in about 15 minutes when you're done with the summary of the film.
Smoke if you got them. Satan Tango opens on a desolate farming village somewhere in the armpit of Hungary. The abandoned buildings that surround the area have all fallen into disrepair, and the remaining inhabitants of the village have followed suit and grown equally moldy and dilapidated from lack of use. The characters of this hellish wasteland are slowly revealed to us throughout the course of the film, with each story more sad and sickening than the next. I won't get into all the stories here in the intro, but the film opens up with a plot between a husband and wife named Mr. and Mrs. Schmidt and Mrs. Schmidt's lover, Futaki. It seems the villagers have come into some money. Not a vast fortune, mind you, but just enough for everyone to keep surviving. However, the trio is planning to make off with the treasure before anyone else notices. That is until they receive word that a mysterious former resident of the village named Aramias has popped up in a local bar. The trio immediately put their nefarious plan on hold, and they set out to figure out if it is true that Aramias has returned. The film doesn't initially show us what the deal is with Aramias. We know he has some control over the villagers, but it's not quite clear what that hold is, and whether he maintains it through force or through some other means. It isn't until about 5 hours into the film that we fully understand Aramias' power. He's a master manipulator. He talks our original trio, as well as the majority of the other villagers, into handing over their money to him, and in exchange he promises to build a new, better life for them in a utopian farming co-op-y thing. Of course, the co-op is an elaborate ruse. Aramias is working on behalf of the military, and what he actually plans to do is disperse all the villagers all over the country and kill them. I know I've barely scratched the surface of this thing, but we're going to get into more detail and talk more in depth about the structure and the different acts of the movie. This is a big movie. It's a lot of movie. I hardly know where to begin, to be honest. But I usually start with whether or not we like the movie. And that seems as good a place to start as any, so let's do it. Tad, how do you feel about Satan Tango?
Okay, so I am a Bellatar fan. Mm-hmm. I've seen every one of his films. This is only the second time I've seen this one, for reasons that are apparent. It's a big time suck, a big commitment. Yes. to sit and watch it. The first time I watched it, if this gives you any insight into my personality, was about It was when I was first getting into Bellator. It was about, about 6 years ago or so. And I was alone on New Year's Eve. I didn't have anything to do or anywhere to go. And so my New Year's Eve, and I don't know what it was, like 2008 or so, was watching Satan Tango.
Perfect time to watch Satan Tango, by the way, because everyone knows New Year's is the worst,
yeah.
Right? I can think of a better way to spend New Year's.
But, I mean, it's not my favorite Bellator film, but I do, and especially on the second viewing, I appreciate it even more. I do really like the film, yes.
Okay. All right. Martin, how about you?
I like Satan Tango, believe it or not. But, like you said, it's not my favorite Bellator film either, and I think there are certain aspects that I find a little bit frustrating with it, maybe unrelated to the length, actually.
Really? Okay.
Yeah, well, like, before I'd seen Seite Tango, I'd already seen Turn Horse and Workmeister Harmonies, and I think Man from London. And one thing I really like in those films is or maybe it's Hranitsky's contribution more to create this a sequence that feels edited without actually having any edits. It's just done through the choreography of the actors and the camera movements. So you kind of feel like, oh, there's close-ups and wide shots, but you go back and look and there aren't any edits.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And there's not really much of that in Satan Tango, so I was a little disappointed.
Yeah, there's a little bit, but I think you're right.
Yeah.
And when it is there, it's like miraculous.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay, so you guys are much better versed in Bellator than I am. Again, it's one of those things I keep meaning to do. One of these days, I'm going to watch Satan Tango. But this was the perfect excuse to do it. And after watching it, I'm going to say I appreciate it more than I like it. But I think it's certainly something that is worth watching and worth talking about, which we're going to do right now.
Mm-hmm.
So your experience watching the movie, did you just sit down and watch all 7 hours straight through? Did you take breaks? Martin?
Most of the time when I watch Satan Tango, I usually take pretty long breaks. It's like the version I have, it's on three different discs. And at each intermission, I sort of leave the film for a little while. And I think like Bellator sort of said that he thinks people should watch the film all at one go, but I kind of think maybe you do need sort of a lengthy amount of time to digest it. So I'll watch it not even in one day. Sometimes I'll watch it over the course of a weekend, like it's a TV miniseries or something like that.
That's probably smart, because I sat down and watched it all in one day, and by the time it was over, I felt like I'd completely forgotten the first half of the movie.
Oh.
Hmm.
Or not, I don't know about completely forgotten. Obviously, I remember vaguely what happened, but it's hard to process everything if you just do it in one big gulp. I did go back and rewatch parts of it. And I think taking bite-sized chunks of it, I think, is actually smart. It's easier to digest.
Mm.
To keep this metaphor going.
The first time I watched it, that New Year's Eve, I started it. I got late into the night. I was tired. I finished it the next day.
Mm-hmm.
This time, just because of my personal schedule, I wasn't, and the fact that you had one of the only two copies of it in town. the other one was at Vidiot's that I had to go much further to drive to get.
I'm so sorry.
So, yeah, I went the night that you posted on Twitter that you were watching it. I had gone the night before looking for it, and they're like, oh, no, it's out. Like,
I know who has it.
but so I didn't get to sit down to watch it till yesterday, and I did take a few – I would break it up a little bit, but I got through about 5.5 hours of it yesterday, and then actually this morning finished the last couple of hours.
Yeah.
And yeah, I think I wanted to go. The Cine family had a screening of it 3 or 4 years ago.
Right.
And I really wanted to go see it. And
you would have gotten a t-shirt.
Yeah.
Is that the one that looks like a roller coaster?
I think so, yes.
Oh, man. Yeah, I wish I'd be able to do that.
Next time. Yeah. Martin, you actually, we were talking about the movie before we started recording or in the weeks prior, and We were talking about the audience. Who is the audience for this film?
Yeah. Well, like, we were sort of joking about it, but, like, on my DVD box on the front, it's got a pull quote from Susan Sontag, which is sort of unusual. But, yeah, I'm sure there are a lot of cinephiles who do appreciate the film. But just from talking to my friends and a lot of people I know who are in the arts, it sort of seems like maybe this film might appeal more to people who aren't as into movies. Like, I have friends who are in photography or animation who seem to like this movie a lot more than people I know who are, like, diehard movie fans. And I don't know if it's just because people who are, like, super into movies often have the most rigid idea of what a movie should be like, or what it is exactly.
It's interesting. Jonathan Rosenbaum is one of the most avid defenders, or not defenders, but proponents, I guess.
Advocates,
thank you, that's the word, of this film.
Yeah, he's one of the people who helped get it on the Sight and Sound list.
Yeah. And he said that in the initial screenings, it was critics who would opt out of going, but the screenings for the general public were packed. So I don't know what... Maybe there's something to the level of difficulty that appeals to just everyday people. Like, it's like an experience more than a film.
Like, some of the people I was talking to, they didn't seem to have such a hard time with it. You know, for them, it was not so different from spending 7 hours at an art gallery or reading a book for 7 hours, something like that. I think they were just approaching it a little bit differently. And I think partly as people who have been conditioned to watch movies that are around that hour and a half, 2 hour runtime mark, maybe that's what throws us off. I don't know.
No, I mean, it doesn't make a whole lot of sense that people who would otherwise be interested in slow cinema or even just art cinema would sort of forego this one. That I don't quite understand that. But is that, do you think that's true, that someone who's, say, into, I don't know, who's Andrei Tarkovsky might dismiss this one, like Bellatar film, or at least Satan Tango?
My little input to this, I got the chance earlier this year to, you know, I do sound recording to pay the bills primarily, and I had the opportunity to work doing sound on a documentary about Vilmos Zsigmond. You know, great Hungarian cinematographer, and we spent time with him, went up to his place in Big Sur, and it's, I was excited to ask him. I'm like, big Bellatar fan, so we did this drive where we filmed us driving up the coast and talking to him, and so I was like, so, what do you think about Bellatar? Expecting to be like, oh, this cinematography is amazing, and he just... He's like, oh, I think he's so overrated. He did not care for Bellatar at all. I mean, here's a guy who's, you know, made some of the biggest, you know, mainstream block. And I think his sensibility is just a very much more sort of Hollywood kind of storytelling. Mm-hmm. And he just did not care for it.
Right,
you know?
Right.
And then this summer I got the chance to go, I was in Hungary and asked one of our tour guide, and I mentioned, I was like, oh yeah, I really like, you know, Hungarian cinema, especially Bellatar. And he knew it, and he's like, oh yeah, Satan Tango, or they pronounce it Satan Tango. And he was like, he knew of it, but didn't seem like, you know.
Yeah,
he
not
was,
his cup of tea.
No.
Yeah. So, yeah. But you guys, again, have seen... or more well-versed in his work, are his other films as daunting? Obviously, they're not as long.
I mean, this is... It's fairly typical of a style as far as the pacing. I mean, there's differences, as Martin pointed out, from some of the other films. His first three films were actually completely different style. They were more like a gritty, handheld, like John Cassavetes-type social dramas. Mm-hmm. And then something, he made three films in that style, and he had, I think, his fourth film, and that was a little more stylized. It was leaning towards this style that he finished his career in, but it was kind of not quite as austere. And then the rest of the films after that are all pretty much in this basic style, where long, long takes with steady cam or dolly moves and everything. And yeah, so it's fairly typical of the second part of his career.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, I think some of the later ones might be more accessible. Maybe. I mean, like, I think they actually get even longer, like the average shot length in Workmeister Harmonies. I think it's like 50% longer or something like that. But I think, like, for some reason, it immerses me a little bit more. I feel like it's a little bit more relatable. Or even something like Man from London, it's almost like a classic film noir or Weimar Republic kind of crime drama. It sort of feels a little bit more like that. Satan Tango, I think it's... Like, his first three films, I think they're sort of very focused on the social, political aspects of living in Hungary. And I think you still see a little bit of that in Satan Tango. It's in some ways a transitional film, I think, between his earlier films and the last three.
Well, I think inevitably, whenever we start talking about a movie... I, by the end of it, I usually have come around and decided that it's one of the greatest movies ever made. So maybe we should just jump right in and start talking about what happens in the movie. Obviously, there's a lot. There's so much.
And it's interesting, too. Like, it kind of – maybe it's a transitional point, like, between – because what you were just saying, like, there's – I read one of the few things that I read, had time to read in preparation for this, was a review on Vice about the film, where the guy's like, you should really go see this film, or you should see the film. And he points out that plot-wise, like, he's like, this film is much more similar to a Quentin Tarantino film than a Terrence Malick film. Mm-hmm. Like, it's, you know, it's kind of got a hard-boiled thing as far as the plot. It's just that it's not handled like that kind of a movie normally would be.
True.
But, you know, it's about people deceiving each other, and there's all these intrigue going on and people having affairs, and you know,
there are explosives.
Yeah.
well we'll get there. But let's dive in. Let's talk about specifics. Let's start with the characters. Forgive me if I have mispronounced any of the names. I'm sure I have. Feel free to correct me. But, okay, so Aramaeus.
I think it's Aramaeus.
Aramaeus. That sounds right.
Yeah, in Hungarian, all the S's are sh. So, like, Budapest Estika. Is Budapest.
Yeah.
Oh, dear.
As they pronounce. So, anything that's just an S is a sh sound.
Good to know. Good to know. How about Futaki? Futaki.
Sounds right.
Right? Okay. Did the bartender have a name?
I don't think we ever heard it.
Okay.
If it did, it was only mentioned maybe once or twice. Yeah. I didn't catch it.
Yeah. The bartender was a really interesting character, but we'll get to him. Let's start off with... Let's go act by act,
okay,
if we can.
Can we talk about the opening of the film?
Yes. With the cows. Most importantly, I think they're the main characters.
After the first time I saw it, you know, like I said, it was a New Year's Eve. It was a long night. I was tired. And all that I really remembered, I mean, I remembered the basic stuff immediately afterwards, but as time passed and my memory of the film kind of faded, the two things that stuck out to me were the scene with the cat and the opening shot.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, it's like, I didn't realize how brilliant that opening shot was till I got to near the end of the film, where you have, okay, it's a 7.5 hour film. The opening shot is 7.5 minutes, and it's emblematic of the basic, like, basically what happens in the film is all encapsulated in that opening shot. You know, there's the cows, there's one that's kind of going around half-heartedly trying to have sex with the other cows, and then it kind of gives up. It's kind of sad. And then eventually they all mill around in the dirt and look pretty miserable, and then they end up leaving and leaving the town. And that's like, that's what happens to the people in this movie.
Pretty
and I
much.
Was like, wow, that opening shot was amazing.
Yeah.
So that's one of the things that has stuck with me over the years.
It is a perfect encapsulation of the film. Do the cows go off? I guess they go off to be slaughtered inevitably, right?
I suppose
that is their fate.
Or maybe they get away like the horses.
Maybe. Yes. So animals play a huge role in the film. They're scattered throughout. We have, as we mentioned, the cows. We have the cat, that poor cat. Mm-hmm. There's an owl that's prominently featured. There are pigs. There are dogs. Do the creatures, separate creatures, all represent different things, or is it all, they're all part of the same muck that's spread throughout the film? Are they, the horses seem like they're, the horses in particular seem like they have a different function in the movie than the
For
pigs
me,
or the cat.
I mean, that was the one thing, like, to counterpoint what I was just saying about the cows in the opening and the people are the cows in the village. The horses appear and they have a similar kind of introduction where they come into this big square, but they're running and they're free and they're in this big group. And who are the people that are there to witness it? Mm-hmm. It's our three, I don't know what you want to call them.
Villains,
you know, Yttermiash, Petrina and Sunny, I think was the name, the kind of young kid who's their accomplice. And it's like, they're the ones getting away with everything. Mm-hmm. It's mm-hmm. like the horses are the, you know, out there running free and happy.
So, right, right.
Yeah, I think those two, for me, have a very, that's a very conscious and definite kind of metaphor. The owl and the cat have to be, I don't know about, like, the pigs and the dogs.
They're out there in the muck.
Yeah. I guess the pig was there with the doctor.
The doctor, yeah.
Right? So maybe, yeah.
That's not subtle. That's mm-hmm. not very nice.
The cat, I think it's a little bit less abstract because we see in a very literal way we're told that Ishtika, how she's abused, and then you see her taken advantage of with the money tree and her kind of taking out her frustrations on this cat. It's very literal how the violence trickles down or the cruelty trickles down to the smallest one.
Mm-hmm.
Like you said, that the other animals, it's maybe a little bit more symbolic. Like the owl definitely made me think of Yarmish's gaze kind of over this community and the broken down mansion, like owls being able to see into the night. Like it made me think of some kind of overseer figure. It's very ominous.
Really?
Yes.
We can't forget about the spiders.
Yes. What did the spiders represent?
Again, it made me think of Irmish, like, laying his trap out for everyone,
yes.
How the spiders kind of come out and they lay their webs over all the people after they pass out.
Yeah. They do quick work, those spiders, after one evening. But yeah, I think that I buy it. But okay. The film is divided into 12 chapters. Apparently, that is somehow connected to the tango. Of course, I know nothing about the tango, but there are 12 acts, and I feel like we should probably step through what happens in each of them and the significance of each.
Question.
Yes.
If I don't know if you guys did any more research than I did, which was none, on the book that it's based on.
Mm.
I'm wondering if those are chapters from the book.
I believe so. Yes.
Okay.
I believe so. Martin, do you know?
Mostly, I think I have the book sitting on my shelf. I haven't actually read it, but I think maybe they're just translated differently, like with the chapter headings. Like they're different than the chapter translations that were on my DVD. So I think it might just come down to translation differences, but I'm sure the book gets structured in almost the same way.
Yeah.
Gotcha.
Yeah. Well, I mean, is it helpful to go through each one?
Sure.
Sure.
Yeah, why not?
Why not? Okay. Okay, so it starts with the news is they are coming. And as I mentioned, that's where we see Mr. Mrs. Schmidt plotting with Futaki, who is Mrs. Schmidt's lover.
One of
her many
lovers. As we come to find out.
She's not particular. But What was your takeaway? Obviously, this is our introduction to the film. What was your, aside from the astounding opening shot? This is sort of establishes the world, and we see the film opens with Futaki describing his dream and how he was I don't know if it was his dream, but he says he was awoken by the sound of bells, and then Mrs. Schmidt describes her, she has this terrible nightmare about the world starts, she's confronted by, I believe, her husband, I think, and the ground starts shaking out from underneath her. And then in the middle of this conversation between Mrs. Schmidt and Futaki, Mr. Schmidt walks in and tells her of his plan to steal the money and head out of town. But what's established in this scene beyond the that plot? But that ultimately that plot, that scheme doesn't prove terribly important in the plot wise.
Yeah, that the their plot to make off with the money just kind of dies off.
Like, yeah.
There's not even a like, oh, well, I guess we're not going to do that. It just never happens.
Exactly.
We yeah. Forget about it.
Exactly. Yeah. But what was your initial takeaway when you saw that scene or those scenes, that series? Martin?
It is kind of a big red herring because it does almost set it up like it's going to be a film noir or some kind of a crime story.
Right.
I think it's also the first place where you hear Ermesh mentioned, that he's coming back and they thought he was dead.
Right, exactly. Yeah. After, I think it's, someone walks in and tells them, I think it's, is it Mrs. Craner?
Yeah, I think it's Mrs. Craner who comes in and, she's like, yeah, they're here.
Yeah.
And she kind of barges in there.
Yeah.
I mean, part of, for me, the thing that's like, the structure of the film, I mean, is, you know, has this sort of, non-linear, flashbacky, you know. So we see when Futaki leaves, he sneaks out, Mr. Schmidt comes out and then goes back in, and then Futaki comes, knocks on the door. And then later we see the doctor watch this whole, and we see the whole thing play out. So like that aspect of it is one thing that I actually really enjoyed, is that we have that sort of Rashomon-like, we see scenes from different angles, different perspectives, and it reveals a little bit something. Okay, there's something else that's going on in most of the scenes.
Right.
That's nice, you know, nice peeling back of the onion layers that for me was one of the parts of the film that I really, really enjoyed.
Precisely, yeah. I think my takeaway was, I mean, I was left with a lot of questions after that first chapter. Like, when is this supposed to take place? We don't see any evidence of indoor plumbing, mm-hmm. but there's modern materials that we see.
Yeah, the whole time I was like really unclear about that until we get to one of the later, you know, into hour five or six, and
yeah.
there's a TV.
Right.
So I'm like,
exactly.
Okay. Because before that, I was like, it could be turn of the century almost,
right.
You know, but then at least it's at least 1950s.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's probably 1950s, 1960s, you know.
Yeah.
So how it feels to me.
Yeah. I mean, I got the impression, maybe it was just because of the way it was shot and had like really crisp blacks, where it felt modern. Like it would almost looked, the cinematography looks like something that might have been shot in the digital age, though I assume this was shot on film. There's something very modern looking about it, but at the same time, it also looks like these people don't have any of the conveniences of modern life. So it's all very strange. Also, as you're watching this first chapter, do you get a sense of like the isolation and home? Almost like this is some really, not maybe it's like some really gross diorama kind of, or the sense that like it's this is a community, but it almost doesn't look real.
I know what you mean. Like it's hard to put a finger on it, but like maybe not quite so much in this chapter. But there were definitely parts of the film where, like for film, where some parts feel so immersive. There's also parts that feel very distancing. It's almost like Brechtian theater. It's
yeah.
It's really hard to pinpoint what the differences are between some of the scenes, but there's times where I was very sort of hyper conscious that I was watching people saying lines through the lens of a camera.
Mm-hmm. So the next section is
before we move on. I had a thought of one thing that I think this section does one of the functions it serves. I mean, these are the people that he's chosen to introduce us to first is, I think, somewhat significant. We hear about Irmiash, we hear about other people, but it's like Futaki, I think, Mr. and Mrs. Schmidt are fairly prominent through a lot of the film, but towards the end, the last couple of chapters, they sort of don't do a lot. They're right there with the whole group of people, but they sort of disappear. But Futaki is one of the most interesting, if not the most interesting character, I think. Mm-hmm. And he is the one who, even though he kind of quiets down for a while and Irmiash takes over, you know, a lot of the plot, you know, that last, when Irmiash is kind of sending everybody to their different places that he's assigned them to go, Futaki is the only one who stands up for himself. And he's right, like, nah, man, I'm not going to go do that. I'm going to go do my own thing,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
So it's, I think the fact that we're, and it seems like this scene, like this opening scene is really mostly from his perspective. You know, when Mr. Schmidt comes home, we go with Futaki into the room where he's hiding and we follow him outside and back in. So I feel like that's one of the functions that it does serve, is it really sets him up as one of the primary characters, if not the primary character in the film.
Indeed. Yeah. So. Yeah. Okay. So, but next we have We Are Resurrected, where we finally get to see Irmiash along with Petrina, his cohort.
Sidekick.
Yes, sidekick. they're the dastardly duo of the film, but I don't know. They go to this, I guess, military building, some government building, and where they get their orders. And I was kind of confused as to what their orders were. Maybe it was just, I was having trouble paying attention at that point.
No, it's very vague because everything's kind of done through these insinuations, and it's not really until the last few chapters where you kind of figure out exactly what's going on, that Irmiash is really working for the government or that they have some kind of an arrangement.
Right, right. What was your initial takeaway from the introduction of the big villain, the big bad? What did you think of him?
He's very, he looks like the devil, right?
Yeah, God, he does have that goatee, yeah.
I was trying to figure out, Mihaly Vaik, he's also the composer for the film.
I know.
I was trying to figure out if he really spoke like that, or if that was sort of an affectation he was putting on as an actor. He has this very sort of peculiar way of speaking, right? It sounds really weird to me, that the way he speaks. Right? Or
the sort of, the sing-songy kind of.
Yeah, it's like a very unusual kind of cadence.
Yeah. Mm. On the first introduction, I was kind of, I mean, we see that Petrina is sort of enamored with him. And my reaction was, are you kidding me? This guy with his, I don't know, he seems so... it seemed pretty obvious to me that he was very disingenuous, even though I didn't know what to expect from the character. But anyone who speaks in poems or like little in haikus, I think I'm immediately mistrustful. I already had misgivings about him. But Tad, how about you?
I was a little confused because they go in, they say they're answering a summons, I think is the phrase, the word that they use when they come in, and the like captain guy that talks to him, you know, he's like, oh, you're a gypsy, you're really lazy, you don't respect the law. So it confused me later when it's like, oh wait, they're like collaborating with the government. 'Cause at the beginning it felt like they were on the verge of getting arrested by this guy,
right,
or something.
Right,
so
yeah,
it like kind of threw me. I didn't know what to think of him.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That whole section is very mysterious, mm-hmm, and remains mysterious even after a couple viewings.
Mm-hmm.
But next we have Knowing Something, I think. Mm-hmm. And that is our intro to the Doctor, right?
The Doctor's my favorite character.
The Doctor is fantastic. heartbreaking. That's among the toughest ones to watch. But why is he your favorite, Martin?
I guess I it's just easy to identify with him because he's also sort of a spectator in all of this. He's the one sort of observing and trying to keep track of all these other characters and figure things out. Mm-hmm. And he's the one that seems maybe the most wary of the outside world. He's kind of a homebody, they mention. But yes. It's also sort of painful when you see he's... I'm not sure if it's because he's a diabetic. He was injecting himself some kind of needle, but he seems mm-hmm. to have these collapses yeah. or goes into comas. And it's very distressing when you see him collapse and the camera lingers on it for a very long time. And you're sort of not sure at first if he's ever going to get up, if he's died. And this happens several times over the course of the mm-hmm. chapter. And at a certain point, it almost becomes a little bit funny, like Danny McBride and Pineapple Express or something, but then like it just keeps going until you feel uncomfortable again, and it just it's very I like this chapter a lot.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think in the beginning we aren't sure. There's a voiceover, there's someone narrating, and we don't really know who it is. And then in this chapter, I guess it's revealed that it's the doctor. Mm-hmm. And you're right, he's the most misanthropic, perhaps, or he's the agoraphobe. He does not leave the house.
I have a feeling he listens to a lot of podcasts.
Yeah.
But like he also seems somebody who's very knowledgeable. Like he's got that poster on his wall of the solar system, and I think just as the doctor, he's somebody who would have a little bit more intimate knowledge into each of the people in the community.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't yeah. recognize him at first, but I guess the actor Peter Berling, he's actually German, and he was in a whole bunch of like Werner Herzog films and Rainer Werner Fassbinder, and I think he was even in some Martin Scorsese films. I was
really
after. So like I didn't recognize him at all in this movie, but apparently he's been around. So
I didn't realize that either. Yeah. No, I've seen a bunch of Herzog and all those guys. I did not recognize him.
Interesting. Mm. Yeah. But is he the character we most relate to, Tad?
I hadn't really thought in terms of relating to any of these characters until you mentioned that just now. Like, they're people that I'm observing, and it's like I don't know that I've super identify with anybody except maybe Futaki.
We talk about the effect of the long take, which I'm sure we'll get into more as we throughout the discussion, but there is the long take in this film just invites this sort of perverse voyeurism, and I think that is especially easy, and we are asked to do it a lot in the section with the doctor, which in some ways it's kind of like a Rear Window kind of situation.
Well, I think actually, like, Bellatar must be, like, a huge fan of mid-career Hitchcock, because his films are just, like, littered with little Hitchcock homages. Like, I think there's also maybe a Rope homage, and I think the film he did after, like, the ending has a big reference to the 39 Steps, and I think, like, his particular gaze, I guess, it's not so different from Hitchcock's, you know, and, like, some of the scenes where they're just talking out, you know, and the scene sort of plays out to its fullest. Like, it does remind me of Dial M for Murder or something like that.
Interesting. Yeah. Now that you said that, I do sense like a certain contempt for his characters, and so an equal parts contempt, and in some cases, like, there's a pity. There's, I would say there's some affection, but even with someone like the doctor, who we should ultimately feel sympathy for, and I think I do, and out of all the characters, I don't know, the shut-in is the one that I might most relate to, but even so, like, I think we are the way that he juxtaposes the pig and the doctor, I think we're mostly supposed to be repulsed, but I don't know. And I'm also wondering, what is the villagers, while they're all distinct, they all have unique characteristics, is the effect that there is a certain condescension that Bellatar seems to have for all of them? And as I see it, just the way it's shot, they're like little ants, and we're kind of, or like, where they're like bacteria in a petri dish, and we're just kind of observing them and watching them. Like, we have this power over them, and we, whether we choose to relate or sympathize is kind of on us. Maybe. So the job of the spider. I wrote something. I don't know. It was a scene where I believe the trio sets out to go. Do you have it in front of you, Ted?
Yeah. Well, the Kellerman, our guy with the big beard, who later on just like starts talking and talking and talking and repeating himself. Yeah. Yeah. He might be my favorite character.
Okay.
That guy cracks me up. He comes in and he's telling people like, yeah, Irimiesh and Petrina, they're coming. I saw them at the bar. And so it's the whole scene is taking place basically at that pub there in the town. Mrs. Schmidt comes in. She starts having a drink while they're debating if Irimiesh and Petrina, when they're going to arrive. And that's when she starts. She sits down. And she's like, what's that smell? Mm-hmm. And they're like, it's the spiders. Mm-hmm. And she gets down on the ground and she's like, no, it's the earth. Mm-hmm. She smells the ground.
Mm-hmm. Stinky spiders.
Yeah, the
Mrs. Schmidt character is really interesting because I started the film thinking she was going to be the savior somehow, because there's something about the way, maybe it's sort of her acting style, or just maybe the way she looks. It reminded me of the actress from Rome Open City in Mamma Roma, Rossellini's. What's her name?
Anna Magnani?
Anna Magnani. But something about her, she's beautiful, but in a really unconventional way. And there's something also sort of, there's a world weariness to her and her face. You can just, it reads so clearly. But then throughout the course of the film, I don't know if it's just the power of suggestion and the way others talk about her, but she becomes repulsive almost. It was a really strange character arc. She doesn't change very much, but somehow I put some trust in her. And then ultimately I think it was when she sort of slowly recedes to the background and becomes just another pawn for Irimiesh, I felt sort of betrayed because she did seem to have this wisdom about her. Her and Futaki, they seemed like people I could, that had a sense of the world. But ultimately, And in that scene in particular where she says, no, it's the earth, it's the smell of the earth, there was something, she seemed to be in touch with some, I don't know if it was like mysticism or just had had an understanding about the world. Mm-hmm. And ultimately that proves to be untrue or unfounded.
Well, is this also the chapter where somebody says not to read Genesis, but to read Revelations?
Yes, I think so. Where Mrs. Croner. But she's set up as being ridiculous from the outset.
She is.
Right?
Right. There's not, I think, as much redemptive qualities to her. Like, I think she's also the one that was chopping up all the furniture. I think she said so that the gypsies won't stab it. she's horrible.
Kind of the worst. But do we learn anything else important in that scene beyond that Croner?
The other thing that happens is we meet our like bartender guy.
Yeah.
And he kind of goes in the back. He starts breaking up shit and he's like pissed. They're coming back. And he's like, they're not going to take, this is my stuff. They're not going to take it away. And
right.
At first, I was unclear. I was like, okay, is he in on this money deal that's been going on? And then we learned later that Irimiesh suggested plant onions or something.
Yeah, just because he said to plant onions.
He's like, the best ideas are the simplest ones, and it was his idea, but I was the one who did all the work, so I'm keeping all my stuff, and he has no right to come. He thinks that Irimiesh is going to come take everything from him. And,
right.
Right.
Yeah, because he's interesting as one of the few characters that's not in on this whole money deal.
Right. Yeah.
He's an out. The doctor are two kind of the two outsiders,
right,
in this
and
village.
Sort of the prostitute, the mother of.
Oh. Yeah, I never did connect the lady, the prostitute that the doctor goes up and sees in the upper level. I didn't figure out which one she was. If she reappeared later,
I don't think so, but I thought that woman was somehow related to the woman in the bar, who is Eshtike's
mother. Oh, she's like one of the daughters that she keeps talking about.
Yes.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yes,
yeah.
But... Yeah, so we didn't really talk about what the doctor's journey in the first part, in the knowing something part, but just backtracking slightly, what we see is he goes out, he does nothing all day but observe the rest of the villagers and drink fruit brandy, but he's run out of fruit brandy, so otherwise, and his maid has just quit, so he's got to go venture out of his house to go find more fruit brandy. And along the way, he has an encounter with one of the town prostitutes, and he sees Eshtike. Why is that hard to say? And ultimately loses his way because it's cold and rainy. And no, that'll teach you. Do not ever leave the house. But I guess has some sort of stroke or for whatever reason collapses in the woods and is picked up by some stranger and is taken somewhere mysterious. We don't really know.
Well, he comes back later. He said he was in the hospital for 13 days when he comes back at the end of the film. And so presumably after he collapsed, he was taken to the hospital.
Right. So, yeah, just so to keep our story straight. Okay, so after the job of the spider, we have Come Unstitched, which is probably...
This is the big one.
Yes, this is the most memorable. You know, that's a judgment call, but I'd venture to guess that most people would say this is the most memorable part.
Yeah, there's definitely, like, the fact that you see the little girl with the cat on all the posters or... Like that's the image you usually see of the film, I think shows that probably most people feel that way about it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I mean, this could be like a feature film in its own right.
It almost is. It feels very separate from the rest of the movie. It seems like, I'm not sure. Ultimately, like this, while this is the most harrowing part of the movie, it feels out of place. I suppose thematically it relates to this idea that the smallest among us will bear the brunt of human cruelty, and the cat being ultimately the most powerless creature in this town gets tortured by someone only just one rung above in the power structure. So, in that sense, it relates, but. It is almost a separate movie.
Yeah, it's the only... I mean, it's we only really see Eshtike, if I'm not mistaken, one other time in the film when we go back to the dance sequence and we see her looking in the window.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, and then, well, when she's dead, laying out there.
Right.
She's there, obviously. But, I mean, that's... the only other time in the movie we see her besides this section. It comes just a little before the midpoint of the film. And I think there's significance that in the center of the film is this story of this young, powerless, innocent. Well, that's maybe debatable.
Right. Who is innocent?
In
yeah.
World. But, she's more of a victim than probably anybody else in the film. And mm-hmm. she's kind of, I think that, maybe it gives us a hint that this might even be the key to the film is like the fact that we've got it all bookends around this central story that is totally outside of the rest of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Martin, what was your takeaway?
It's awful that she kills her cat, but where it really becomes kind of like interesting and heartbreaking is later when she regrets it and she wishes she can undo it and she knows that she can't.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's a little bit funny, actually. When you're in the doctor's chapter, she comes running up to him near the end of that chapter, and it's almost like this funny little throwaway nuisance. Like, he's having a hard time getting up the hill and this little girl's bothering him. But, like, in this one, just by changing the visual perspective, it also completely changes the emotional meaning. It's, like, just hard to unpack emotionally what's going on. But I think you're right that this is kind of the maybe Rosetta Stone for the whole film.
Hmm.
I think at the end, when she's poisoned herself and she's lying there and dies, the narrator comes on and he's talking about what she's thinking about as she's dying. Something to the effect that she knew that all these things were happening for some kind of a reason, mm-hmm. you know. But that, again, that signals to me that, okay, there is some kind of a purpose for telling this story, that she's, and why this is the central part of it, that saying, okay, there's a reason that all these things are happening, that all these people are, you know, having this experience.
Right. Doesn't it say something about her feeling comfortable at the end? It wasn't a painful experience.
I think
so. And that she meets an angel of some or something. Mm-hmm. And ultimately it's a peaceful ending for her. That seems at odds with the rest of the movie where, well, I don't want to get, we'll get to it by the end.
Well, I mean, it could also be ironic because, like, at the beginning, she's framed as being a little bit naive, where she thinks that by planting the money, she's going to have a money
right.
tree growing, and it's just so her brother can steal it. So I don't know if we're meant to take this final thoughts that, okay, it's all for a reason, that, you know, the angels will understand what I'm doing, killing myself in penance for taking
right.
my cat, and that everything's going to be okay. I think maybe... like, as viewers in this film, we're maybe not supposed to take that as being the reality of the film. I think maybe we're supposed to understand that this is...
true. But who is our narrator? Is it the doctor? And if so,
I don't think so.
But is he reliable? Why?
Yeah, I didn't get that. I thought that it was, an omniscient narrator. I didn't think of it as the doctor, but it may
okay.
be. I'd have to look at it again.
Yeah, but. I know at least part of it is the doctor, but I think this is the doctor's, that was the impression I got, that this is the doctor's story. It is the doctor giving us the narration, and I don't want to, I feel like we're jumping ahead a few steps, but ultimately it would be very strange for him to give her such a hopeful ending given what happens later. Let's just close out the cat sequence, as it shall henceforth be known. Martin, I know in previous discussions we've talked about films that show animal cruelty. And I know you and I have said that we are perhaps less sensitive to it than a lot of other people seem to be. It seems to be like a really big trigger for a lot of people.
It's definitely distressing watching the cat in the film, but I think it's
yeah.
like the reality is that it's not quite as bad as it looks. Some of it sort of enhanced with the sound design, those like the high-pitched cat sounds, I think make it feel sort of worse than it is. And like her kind of rolling, tumbling thing with the cat also, it kind of looks worse than I think it might actually be. Like, I think if I saw a little girl playing with a cat like that, I'd be like, hey, ease up with the cat.
Yeah, I found that this time around, the first time I was like really kind of distressed by
yeah,
it. And this
yeah.
time around, it was not as bad as my memory of it was. That
yeah.
yeah, she's rolling, but you can see that she sort of, she doesn't roll on top of it. She, you know, she
yeah.
it's kind of to the side, and yeah, it's the cat, I'm sure, is not super happy, but
yeah.
it wasn't as bad as I kind of, it had lent itself to be in the, my mind.
Okay.
I think for me, almost the cat in the net hanging there,
oh,
like, and
yeah.
her force feeding it the rat
yeah,
poison was almost worse than
yeah.
the rolling around.
Yeah. You know? I like I said, I'm not usually very sensitive to these things, but this one was really upsetting.
Yep.
It just, why are you making me watch this? Why? And it's not a trigger for me. It's not something that will... it's not something I look for when deciding whether or not to watch a movie. Like, other things... There are things that certainly come into play. Like, am I going to watch this? If there are certain violent things that happen, perhaps not. Mm-hmm. As I was doing a rewatch, like a piecemeal rewatch, I couldn't go back and rewatch this scene. I was like, mm-hmm. I did not need to experience that again. Mm-hmm. Even though the cat is presumably fine. Apparently, he is living with Bellatar.
That's what I was going to say. I think I had read that he... It was Bellatar's cat afterwards.
Yeah. But it was just really tough to watch. And it's to have an intellectual discussion about what is happening in that scene is difficult because it's horrible. It's horrible. And I can't even imagine being that little girl, that actress, and having the director tell you, now what you're going to do is you're going to shake this cat and you're going to roll around with it and then you're going to put it in a net and hang it up. And then you're going to stuff its head into a bowl of milk repeatedly. Like, I can't... That's so terrifying to think about. But... I mean, I'm not alone in thinking that, and I will admit that's largely my takeaway from that scene. But there, you're also right in that it does serve as a microcosm of the larger themes of the film. And while it does feel sort of separate from the rest of the film, it does relate back to some of the things that we've already talked about the power of the individual and the callousness of how callous people can be.
And I think also that naivete or innocence won't protect you from the heaviness of the world or the harshness of the world. I think that's something that does come back also later in the film.
Right. And also, and that naivete does not necessarily mean angelic or good. Mm-hmm. To be naive doesn't necessarily make you a saint. Mm-hmm. Innocence doesn't necessarily, and just because you don't have wisdom doesn't necessarily mean that you are good.
Yeah, and for me, you know, she had been institutionalized, they'd come back. I think the things that she's saying to the cat, she's completely acting out the things that have been done to her. Like,
right.
I'm stronger than you. What, you know, she talks about, like, pissing the bed or pissing your pants or mm-hmm. something. Obviously, she's just completely acting out what has happened to her. I don't know whether at the institution or at home with her family.
Right.
And for me, that was this time. The first time I had this similar reaction to you, Lady P, where I was, like, overwhelmed by what I was seeing being done to this poor animal.
Yeah.
This time it was more, I felt my heart broke for the little girl, for Eshtike, because it was like, oh, this is revealing to me. She's acting this way because she has been so badly abused.
Right.
And that was what I took away from it this time more than the other.
Right.
It was my heart, which had broke for this little girl.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. In the scene, we get a glimpse of what happens in the next scene, which is the job of the spider 2, or the devil's tit, Satan's tango. the girl looks through a window of the bar of the tavern and sees the grown-ups having a grand old time, and then after that decides to go off and kill herself. But let's move on to what she's actually looking at, which is Satan's Tango. What is Satan's Tango? This is where we get the title of the movie. But what is happening in this scene? It's primarily the grown-ups dancing the night away and getting hammered and ultimately collapsing. But there's a lot of really interesting stuff happening here. When I was looking on the internet, a lot of people said that this was the most tedious scene of the movie. Did you have that experience?
It's interesting to compare it with another dancing sequence in another Bellatar film, in if I'm not mistaken, Werkmeister Harmonies, correct me if I'm wrong, Martin, where there's a scene where this guy is talking about the rotation of the planets and the solar system, and he's using people in as sort of, he's creating a visual representation of the rotation of the solar system using people in this room. And there's kind of this lengthy sort of dance sequence, which is mesmerizing and beautiful and like poetic, and it's in a really incredible sequence. This has a similar kind of thing happening where it's a long dance sequence, but it's not nearly as interesting.
I agree, but I think it does also sort of connect to the larger themes of the movie. Like, I was sort of thinking like what the Satan tango might be or what it might mean, and I think tango, you know, you're going like three steps forward, three steps back, or something like that, right? And I think the fact that they're sort of dancing all over the place, that they're moving but not getting anywhere, it sort of made me think of just in general people moving forward without actually progressing. And even the structure of the film, I think the fact that we have this sort of chapter forward, chapter backward, two chapters forward, two chapters back sort of structure, I think that's maybe also the devil's tango. Satan's tango. Like, and I was sort of looking a little bit just into the origins of the word Satan. Like, I think that the root of the word, it doesn't mean like evil. It means opposition, almost like a legal opposition. So it did make me think that it's maybe slightly less nefarious, and it's more just the inability to get anywhere as a, maybe as a species or as a dancer or what, however you want to connect that to life.
So the guy with the mustache who dances with Mr. Schmidt, you didn't get a vibe from him?
Maybe a little. I mean, it's hard to have a mustache that big and look a little insidious.
Exactly.
One thing that when we started talking about this, this is in the same sequence where Kellerman is just talking incessantly, repeating himself about, yes, they were there, and they were talking about the gunpowder, and I was plotting and plotting and plotting, and he just keeps saying the word plotting over and over, which we see numerous other times throughout the film where people are plodding along. But maybe it relates to this also, where the dancers are just, they're almost plodding along more than dancing in this scene where, like you say, they're it's backwards and forwards and nothing is really happening. Mm-hmm. They're not getting anywhere. They keep walking, but you feel like, and even the way he shoots all those lengthy walking sequences, there's a few, like later in the film, we have our three bad guys who they're walking and the wind is blowing all the trash by them and stuff, and we're tracking with them. And if we feel like we're moving, but there's a lot of sequences where it's, you know, either a static shot or a shot where they're so far in the distance that it feels like they're walking, they're plodding, and they're never getting anywhere, you know.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. I kept, throughout this scene, I kept watching Mrs. Schmidt try and both, like, ward off the handsy dude, the grabby dude in the bar.
Yep.
she was, she didn't, it seemed like she didn't quite know what she wanted out of that scene. Like, I kept thinking, like, any minute now, she is gonna just, like, vomit all over that guy. I'm just waiting for something, for her to do something, or she's gonna, like, smack him across the face, or something. Like, I trying to get a read on her, and she's dancing, and then she seems to go into a fit and like starts flailing around, and I sort of took that as like a metaphor for how how she deals with adversity, or her situation, where sometimes it's easier just to try and make the best of it and just try and dance and have a good time despite the discomfort. And then oftentimes it becomes too much and it's like you start start trying to fight against it, but ultimately that proves fruitless. This person will not stop life will not stop, adversity will not stop. You just keep dancing. So it is this weird dance of the damned, sort of. They're dancing their way to hell. like they're cursed almost. Yeah.
Well, and even like, you know, if the word damned, when talking about it in relation to Satan and this idea of being stopped, like damned is really just being stopped. You know, you're stopping the flow of water or whatever when you dam it. Like, so in that sense of the word damn or damnation, it relates right to what we're talking about, I think.
Yeah.
I feel like for her, this scene, like when she has she dances with, I think his name is Halich, the schoolmaster guy, who the mustache dude, who's like basically says, you know, you deserve someone better than your husband. If you come with me, you know, I'll take you to the city and you deserve better. Mm-hmm. And that's the first time anyone has spoken to her and not just used her as a sex object completely. I'm sure that's a part of it with him, but he's actually like having real talk with her, you know. You can see that in her reaction is like, wow, this guy is, you know, he's planted some kind of a seed. Now this, for me, I think, if I'm not mistaken, this is really kind of where she's been fairly prominent whenever she's been in the scenes up to this point. And after this, she's just kind of in the background.
Right.
She's
not she recedes really, from the frame. It's weird. Know, yeah.
I feel like this is her turning point where she's just kind of like, maybe he hits a nerve there that she just kind of gives up and is like, okay, I'll just be, I don't know.
Yeah.
There's some kind of a turning point there with her, I feel.
Right. She's sort of on the fence. And maybe she's like, but she's fighting against Satan, the devil or whatever, and ultimately gives into it.
Well, and then later on, you know, not too much later, we see her finishing up a little tryst with Irimiash, who is sort of maybe our Satan figure. Mm-hmm. So she's, she has no,
she's accepted her lot of life. It's that is a sad figure, truly. But is there anything else we want to say about the job of the spider part two? The cheese bread? Do we want to say anything
that
about the cheese
amazing.
Bread?
My favorite image in the film, probably. It's the two adorable. People eating the cheese stick. Oh my god, amazing.
What does the cheese stick represent, do you think?
Whatever, yeah.
The food of the damned. The snack of the damned.
Yeah, it is really kind of a surreal kind of sequence, that last shot. There.
Yeah. Yeah, it's the Hungarian hot pocket. Like, where do you have to be in your life? After that scene, we have Aramayesh gives a speech. And this is where the plot really starts moving forward. He basically lays a huge guilt trip on all the communards about the fate of the poor SDK, and somehow worms his way into their brains and convinces them to give him all their money so that he can go off and form some weird new utopian farming village.
He's so over the top, the speech.
Yeah, yeah.
Friends, are we not all guilty?
Yes.
I mean, like, I think this, along with the next couple chapters that sort of go in a sequence, like, to me, this feels like the most political part of the movie, where we're being led by this person who tells us to give up our money and we're going to form this commune, this utopia, and then it turns into a disaster.
Did we have any doubt that this was going to, like, this is the, like, cruelest dramatic irony of in the film, where we know that this will not end well, and yet we watch all of the villagers hand over all of their money. So let's move on to perspective from the front. That's where we see the bartender yelling at his fellow villagers.
Because the bartender brings out Eshtika's coffin and puts it on the car, and he's like kind of talking to, I guess, Eshtika's mother.
What was your reaction to the bartender. What is he doing there? Martin.
I think it's maybe just to let the audience in on the fact that, like, something's going horribly wrong with this. We're not supposed to buy into what Jeremiah is saying. I think maybe not that you would, just purely based on the performances, but... Mm-hmm. You know, it's sort of nice to have another voice that's kind of...
as if we needed more
like
clues.
You think people would...
It's important to have one voice.
Yeah, like sort of criticizing why people can't see through this.
Right. One voice of reason, even if he is a, like, he seems totally irrational and angry. It's telling that he's the audience surrogate, kind of.
I think this is also the chapter where... Mrs. Connor, she's chopping up the wood, right? Like, I think they seem sort of especially petty in this chapter.
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah, I mean, for me, like, the whole, going back to the Irmiash gives a speech where he convinces them to hand over his money, like, if I was more concerned with the narrative of the film actually making complete sense, I would be very critical, like, because I just really don't buy that speech convinces them to just hand over all their money. I think that there's, like, it doesn't make sense to me that they would really, really trust this dude that they've been, like, afraid of, and, like, this whole time, all of a sudden there's a switch that doesn't really make a lot of logical sense to me in my mind.
Right.
But I just kind of... Because there's so many other things about this film, either aesthetically or thematically, symbolically, that are more important to me than the actual plot, mm-hmm. that I just let that...
Just go with it.
My skepticism about that, that believability of that to go, you know?
Do you think it is like a weakness of the film, or do you think it's deliberate maybe for some reason, or is it maybe just Mihaljevic as an actor, or is it the writing? I'm not sure. Because I don't know if there's ever a point in the film at all where we're ever supposed to buy into what he's saying. I think you are supposed to be sort of aware that it's not. And I think he does have, like, a certain kind of charisma where you can at least understand maybe why they're going along with this plan. But I don't know if maybe that's a weak point of the film, though.
Yeah, it remains mysterious why they go along, because he does have these... the power of coercion, but even at this point in the film, it's not clear what his hold is, because it remains unconvincing to the viewer. And I think this is really where I get a sense that really feels it seems like a very patronizing part of the movie, where they go along because they're stupid. I think that is what we are meant to think. And while whatever sympathy we had, or empathy for these characters we had building up going into the sequence, that is immediately eradicated when they decide to go with him. And that's really where I get a sense that Tar is totally contemptuous of these people.
I mean, later on, you know, a chapter or two down the road, when he doesn't show up on time for their meeting, they all start to, they're like, I don't know why we gave him our money. Like, we were stupid to do that. And then he shows up and he sweet talks him back into, he's very manipulative. He gives them their money back and is like, I don't want your money. If you're going to be turn on a dime like this, you're not reliable. And they're like, oh, well, actually, no, let me give you back my.
Yeah.
Like it does. That sequence really speaks to his master manipulation skills. Mm-hmm. His initial speech that convinces him, for me, there wasn't enough of a transition from here's this guy that we're all freaked out is back in town to, oh, let's trust this guy with all this money that we've built our hopes and dreams around.
Right, exactly, know? Yeah.
There's a transitional moment that's missing for me.
Yeah.
Like, it does parallel Eshtiket, like, putting her money in the ground to grow the money tree. I think, like, it is that sort of same kind of naivete that you see reflected in the community as a whole. So, yeah. Like, I don't know. True. I mean, like, people do get misguided. So, like, I think, like, it's not that it rings false. I think maybe you're right. It just, that particular right. moment with the speech just feels a little bit too weak to totally buy into what happens.
Right, right, yeah. Yeah, no, you're right. It's not the... I completely buy that these people could be manipulated. I think it's more we see that they're unhappy. They're clearly not a happy bunch of people. But we don't see Aramayesh exploiting their misery properly to the point where he's not exploiting their specific issue properly. Like, he's promising them something very pie in the sky, but that we have no, there's no real specifics to his plan. Mm-hmm. So I think maybe that's the issue.
I think for me, it's a narrative weakness in that up to the point where he gives his speech, he hasn't had any interaction with them. It's all been them talking about him and he's coming. And except for Kellerman is the only one who's had the interaction. And he's just talking about the whole time that, that he's coming and what he was talking about explosives and blah, blah, blah. Like, I feel like if there was – he had some kind of interaction with them before he gives the speech, then that would be the transitional thing that I needed to believe that they're going to go from freaked out and afraid of this guy to we're going to trust him.
Right.
You know, it was
right.
just a too quick of a transition.
For right. me. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. What we needed was a song like in the monorail sequence in The Simpsons. I think that would have done it, right?
I think if Aramayesh was like a literal Pied Piper.
I think so, yes. He didn't have the right outfit is all. He just needed a what are those called? The like pork pie hats? What are those?
Yeah, pork pie hats.
But it is telling where this film is 7.5 hours and we can't like surely there was enough time for to establish the exact relationship between the villagers and Aramayesh. But
should have been 8 hours.
He just needed one more half hour.
Well, it's funny, like Bellatar said when they originally pitched the film, they pitched it as a 6-hour film, so he said it turned out much longer than he expected.
Oh. Oh, boy. Anyway. Well, we'll get to that. So perspective from the front. I just want to skip ahead a little bit because if we're not careful, this could turn into a 7.5-hour podcast. The going to heaven have nightmares.
This has my favorite funny moment in the whole movie.
What is that?
It's when Aramayesh drops to his knees and watches the fog float by, and it's this very sort of mysterious, mystical moment. It feels almost like something that could be in a Tarkovsky film, but then Petrina says, like, what, you've never seen fog before? Come on, like, yeah. Over it. Like, I mean, it's funny, but like, to me, it did feel like a very sort of post-Tarkovsky, post kind of spirituality, mm-hmm. European outlook that, mm-hmm. you know, there's not really room for that kind of thinking maybe anymore right. in everyday life.
Right. Mm. There is no magic in the world.
I guess.
It's just fog.
What a downer.
It really is. But you're right. I think that is probably my favorite part of the movie. That was hilarious. But in addition to that sequence, we have Aramayesh going to town to purchase explosives. And also we get the villagers go to the manor and they are having dreams and those are expounded on by the narrator. And this is kind of where Aramayesh's plan is finally revealed, right? Even then, I wasn't sure what exactly his plan was, because it's like I was just really focused on that soup. That is one thing that did occur to me throughout the course of the movie is we don't see people eat. They drink a lot, but they don't eat very much. And like, how are they all not starving to death? we finally get to see food that actually looks edible. The movie is so cold, but that was the one scene where it felt like warm, where I got a sense of like they could finally like some sort of creature comfort. Like, it was like almost a relief. But then there was something going on that I still remain, like, it still is unclear to me, like, what is he planning to do? What is the plan? And why? Why is this happening?
Yeah, I never figured that out.
Yeah.
No. Never figured yeah, that out.
I mean, the whole thing with the explosives, like, that's one Chekhov's gun that never goes off.
Yeah.
I think the fact that you never see the plan happen, it's sort of strange, and you're kind of left in the dark, not knowing exactly why anything.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's almost like talking about the Hitchcock references, it's almost like a MacGuffin, you know, where it's like, it doesn't really matter.
Yeah.
You know, I never understand the plan. The plan is just an excuse for all these other things that are happening.
That's right. Yeah.
I mean, we're getting into the next section, I think, but is it safe to assume that the explosives are going to be used on the villagers?
I don't know. I mean, you mentioned that at the beginning. That was that he was going to kill them, and I just thought he was trying to get them out of the way so he could make off with the money.
Okay.
But yeah, I don't really understand what the explosives were for.
Okay.
Maybe it was for them. I don't know.
Okay, that was what I thought, but I'm not sure.
I mean, because, you know, shortly after this, in the Just Trouble and Work chapter, like, the guy that's dictator, they're transposing Irimiesh's notes about everybody, mm-hmm. but kind of changing them to be a little more less vulgar
less cruel. Yeah.
So it's like, okay, he's obviously working for the government. They're transcribing this report of some kind of his, but to what purpose?
Yeah.
I really don't know.
Yeah. Yeah. Hmm. Okay. Well, listeners can tell us what they think is happening. Whether it's that the explosives are used on the villagers or what. We're still a little confused.
Like, not to jump too far ahead, but like the doctor, when he comes back at the end and like it's empty, he doesn't really know either what happened to the villagers, and we're sort of mm-hmm. put in a similar position.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. We don't know either. So in the sequence just following Going to Heaven, Have Nightmares.
Perspective from the Rear.
Perspective from the Rear. I don't know if we... By the way, we forgot to mention Perspective from the Front. I think Mrs. Croner brings up the doctor on their as they're walking towards the manor.
But he'll starve.
He's going to starve, yeah. And Futaki's the one who's like, so let him starve. He's very callous about it. But Perspective from the Rear, this is where the villagers... They put up some protest, but ultimately they consent to let Irimiesh scatter them throughout the country, and meet their fate. The lone holdout is Futaki, who opts to stay behind and have his own assignment. He makes up his own assignment. I'm not sure if that means he has a separate fate from the rest. But he seems to be, it is said in the next chapter, which Tad mentioned, Just Trouble and Work, it's said he is the smartest of the bunch. But I don't know what else to take away from that whole section. To me, that was the most expository section of the bunch. Did you pick up anything new from that?
I mean, it does sort of move things forward. Like, we already kind of touched on it just talking about some of the other chapters.
Right.
Yeah, it moves the plot along a little bit further. Like, it's...
It is.
This section feels just very plotty to me. It's like, there's not some of the sort of philosophizing about life or their misery or their situation. It's very much plot-oriented.
Right.
For me, that's why it's... kind of less interesting, you know?
Yeah. And then the following chapter, Just Trouble and Work, that's where we have the two government officials editing Irimiesh's report. And again, this is another section where people seem to be frustrated by the length. But I actually think it's interesting.
Yeah.
This gets back to the overt political themes of the film. The bureaucratic machine keeps churning and doesn't care about the fate of the people it's supposed to be supporting. Of Irimiesh's language, it is equally unfeeling.
This chapter, it's a little bit funny, and it's sort of also dark how they're kind of reducing everyone's lives through these little dossiers, but it kind of makes me think a little bit of Kafka's writing, and sort of makes me wish that Bellatar had maybe at some point tried to tackle one of Kafka's stories. Like, I think, you know, Satan Tango as a whole sort of makes me wish there was Bellatar's The Castle out there. That would have made me very happy.
Maybe give him, you know, if he's on Twitter, maybe we should tweet at him. Let's get the word out.
Bring him out of retirement.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so, okay. And then finally we have The Circle Closes. Back to the doctor. The poor, forsaken doctor. Alone in the village. And here we get the direct Tarkovsky callback.
Right.
The sound of bells.
It's sort of a subversion of that image, too. Yeah,
yes. It is a absolute, complete subversion. Wherein, I know Martin and I talked about Andrei Rublev on this show, and the triumphant moment of the bell, the final bells ringing at the end, and how that is, it's a release, it's a sublime moment, a moment of faith and a return to belief in humanity and God. And here it represents just the opposite. So we have the doctor waking up to the sound of bells, which Futaki talks about at the very beginning of the movie. And the shut-in doctor, like the bells are so stirring that the shut-in doctor takes to the outside to go investigate. And we, the way it's shot, we are meant to believe. Like, we see, this is the one section of the film that I would describe as beautiful, where even this barren landscape has a sort of tranquil beauty. And then the sequence where, you know, the tracking him to the ruins of the church. But then when we enter the church, we see that there is a man there ringing the bells, and that he is not an angel, that he is I think we're meant to believe a madman or of some sort, or I wasn't sure if he was some sort of preacher or but some false prophet. It was clearly our hopes are dashed, that there is no God is dead, and all that's left are the people who don't have a good hold on the real world. That was my interpretation anyway. Did you guys have a different one?
Well, you know, it's presumably, at least I took it to be like the ruins of a church.
Yeah.
And there's no spiritual message coming out of it. It's the Turks are coming.
The Turks are coming. Yes, yes.
And yes, like you said, it's some kind of a potentially a lunatic,
yeah,
who's there inhabiting this former religious structure,
yeah,
that's in the middle of a wasteland,
right,
and as a piece of wasted architecture itself.
Right. I mean, you know immediately when you see him, like, this is not a higher being. This is, he could be a poltergeist almost. Like, he seems, there's something ghostly about him, but it's almost demonic.
Well, and when the doctor finally gets in there, there's no, at least to my recollection, there's no real acknowledgement of the guy. He just kind of walks through and walks away and leaves, you know? It's not like, oh my gosh, who is this person here ringing this bell? It's almost as though it's maybe a, you know, figment of our imagination, or there's no interaction between them.
Right, right. I mean, maybe he just knows immediately, like, this is nothing. Mm-hmm. And then it's very telling that he returns to his house and starts boarding up the windows and shuts himself in and shuts out the daylight and, I guess, waits to starve to death.
I would.
Waits for death to come. It's tempting to do the same. tempting to follow suit.
I mean, the phrase "the Turks are coming," like, historically, the implication it has is, like, doom is encroaching. The Turks are coming, the Turks are coming. I guess, Eastern Europe anyway. But it feels like the world is ending in that final segment. You know, it could almost lead into Night of the Living Dead or something.
Right.
Totally, yeah.
It's totally apocalyptic.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, the film ends just with, I mean, the doctor is just talking and talking, and it just fades out. It, you know, feels like he's going to go on talking forever to himself in the dark, you know.
Yeah.
really, it was a really haunting ending for me. I was like, wow, this is pretty bleak.
Yes.
And chronologically, like, this kind of comes at the end of the story last chronologically, but I've seen some people sort of interpret it as also being the first, taking place before the first chapter, and that this story is actually circular in some way, that there is no real beginning or end to Seitan Tango.
That's interesting.
I don't know what you guys think about that. Like, I was sort of chewing on that last time I watched it, because it does end with him sort of describing the very first chapter, right?
Yes, it all circles back. That's the those were the bells that
Futaki
was hearing in the beginning. Precisely.
Which is very much like a no exit kind of idea of like, this is just going to go on repeating itself forever. This is hell for these people, and they're damned.
Precisely.
Dancing the Seitan Tango.
Precisely. Yeah. Exactly.
I like that, actually.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'll buy that interpretation.
It's like another film with a cat inside Llewelyn Davis.
Yeah. Oh, no. Oh, man. Oh, man. You're right, Martin. Genius. Okay, well, we've stepped through the movie. I don't like to focus too much on the specific happenings of this movie, but I feel like for this film, it's sort of necessary, and I think it's because it is so hard to get a hold of exactly what the movie is about and what's happening. But I think with that final chapter, it really does all tie together, and that it does the ending, despite, I mean, it's 7.5 hours, but the ending still packs such a wallop. That is the big reveal, that this will continue to happen. As long as there are humans, we will continue to be misled, and we will continue to, people will continue to exploit others' faith in God or higher power to their own ends. And, yeah, we're basically doomed. Yay!
Yay.
Hooray for Hollywood.
Yeah. but, yeah, so I think we've, throughout the course of this discussion, touched on most of the major themes, the individual versus the collective, which I don't know if we've talked about the political context of the time, but 1994, fall of the Soviet Union, beginning of capitalism. So the Aramayesh character, maybe his promise of this new glorious way of life is the promise of capitalism.
I actually thought he was maybe more representation of communism, because he is sort of like taking their money to like redistribute, and they were going to create a commune. Like I think maybe he's more of a stand-in for maybe
communism.
A Lenin type character.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right.
That does make sense. Yeah, and maybe that's why I had such a hard time with this movie, is because it is so very critical of the collective and the power of the collective, and of it seems to make the assertion that that offering up your trust in the government is foolish. And that is not something that I necessarily ascribe to. I think, you know, I'll leave it there, and I'll let you guys talk about that.
Yeah, I mean, like, in Hungary, after, like, a particularly hard relationship with communism, I think I can definitely...
Sure.
...understand. But I think also, like, I'm a little bit skeptical that even Bellatar himself is this critical of, I guess, the idea of communities coming together, because I think when you sort of appreciate Bellatar, you sort of also have to appreciate his collaborators. Like, he works with the same people a lot of...
Right.
Sorry, he frequently works with the same collaborators, so, like, I think he can't be that
right. He
critical
doesn't even
of...
Right, he doesn't describe this, yeah.
Well,
yeah.
I wonder if it's less an attack on the idea of community as much as it is perhaps critical of selfishness and human nature.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we start off the film with people that are basically going to screw over the rest of the community for the selfish purposes.
Right.
I feel like when they do kind of come together under Irmiash's leadership and turn over their money, it's less about, oh, we're really buying into the community, as much as it seems like a better way to get what they want. Mm-hmm. Under his you know, charismatic leadership, and they think, oh, okay, well, I'm not really, he's right, I'm not, we're pretty miserable people that can't seem to get anything together, we just are dreamers, and he's going to be the one that's going to get me what I want. Mm-hmm. Like, I feel like it's less about critical of the idea of community as it is critical about
people.
The idea of people, human people nature, and people being selfish by nature.
Yeah,
you know? People are the worst, and then you get a bunch of them together. Jeez.
Yeah.
But I don't know.
But I think that's my problem with the movie is that I don't think Bellatar actually believes this, because I think what he's saying is it's those other people. Look at these fools. Like it's never me, because the people that I work with, we're all brilliant, obviously. Mm.
I mean, it's interesting, too, that, like, the follow-up film, Workmaster Harmonies, I think, at least from a certain perspective, I think that's, like, an infinitely more hopeful film.
Okay. You know,
I think it's sort of, even from the first scene, it's sort of saying that, like, no matter how dark things get, the eclipse is going to pass and the sun will come out again. And, mm-hmm. I think that feels maybe a little bit more genuine to me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, there's the nihilism of this film is, I think, a little disingenuous coming from, I mean, I understand it coming from a teenager, but,
I mean, when I'm like, especially in a place like Hungary, where, it's full of political disillusionment, you know, it's kind of tough not to prescribe to at least some degree of, nihilism, I guess.
Yeah. I think it's not so much like nihilism. Okay, there are certainly some nihilistic films that I think are amazing. Like, I'm certainly not suggesting that this movie needed to have a happy ending, and indeed that would probably be inappropriate. But I think my issue is that he's condemning others and sort of doesn't implicate the audience enough or himself enough. That's troubling to me. The long takes and the style of the film. Ultimately, there's a sort of remove. The formal elements sets us above the characters in many ways. It sets us apart from them. And I think we're just meant to just sit there and pity them for 7.5 hours. But I did want to talk about a few more things. The soundtrack is really interesting. Mm-hmm. It's mostly diegetic sound. And then the music with that accordion, it's like some sick carnival music. So it's this really, really ironic music that plays over these really desolate images. And yeah, these really harrowing, austere images. And then we have like the merry-go-round music. which maybe merry-go-round music is appropriate. We're going around in circles, right? Not really going anywhere.
I really like the music. For me, is a big part of what helps set the tone for mm-hmm. the film, and mm-hmm. For me, works really well. In general, I really like the music that he uses mm-hmm. in all his films.
Yeah,
it's very effective.
Yeah. Martin, any thoughts?
Yeah, I agree. I think again, like looking to his other films too, that as stylistically similar as they might appear at first glance, they reflect pretty different tones. And like the soundtracks kind of, they might tip you off to that.
Yeah. So let's wrap this thing up, shall we?
Probably.
Let's do that. Woo. All right. So this is the 36th movie on the Sight and Sound list. I think listeners will probably gather that we have sort of mixed feelings about the film, but let's just reiterate those feelings one more time. The 36th spot. Martin, do you think it is worthy of the 36th spot?
Well, I think maybe it's partly because of its size, but this has sort of become the flagship of Bellatar's career as a filmmaker, and maybe even to slow cinema as a whole. But I don't think it's the best. I would sort of maybe rather... have one of the other two that are on the list. You know, if you have to have a Bellatar film this high, maybe have one of the other ones on the list, Turin Horse mm-hmm. or Workmaster Harmonies. I think those are better films, actually, I think.
Yeah.
I don't know if there's like something, I'm sorry, Susan Sontag. I might just be missing something with this film, but I feel like I just can't buy into it as much as his later films, as sort of impressive as I think it is. I mean, like, if you want something that sort of covers the kind of thematic territory that Satan Tango does, but I think it's like very short and colorful. You know, you could watch something like Milos Forman's Fireman's Ball, which I'm surprised isn't on the list. Mm-hmm. You know, I think like for what it does, I think Satan Tango, it's very impressive, but I don't necessarily think it should be this high on the list. That's my...
Yeah. Fair enough. I quickly want to mention that it is tied with Jean Dielman and Metropolis. So, yes, interesting company. And yeah. I know, Martin, you said that you believe that Tar and Lang have a lot of similarities.
I think they do.
Prior to recording, we were talking about how Lang and Tar share a love for sort of grizzled faces, an affection for sort of men who look like they've been through the ringer, sort of malformed.
Yeah, I think like two filmmakers that I think you definitely see inspire Bellatar, like I think it's probably Fritz Lang and Alfred Hitchcock, weirdly enough. And like both those filmmakers used Peter Lorre in their films, and I could totally see Peter Lorre fitting into Satan Tango.
Yeah.
if that film had been made in the right era.
Yeah. Tad, what do you think? 36th spot?
I think Martin put it really well. I'm pretty much in agreement with that. I think it's an amazing film on a lot of levels. It's not Tar's most successful film. Yes, probably because of the behemoth size of it, that it up to the other ones, because I do think the others are better films.
Yeah. Yeah. This is the most notorious of his films. This is a legendary film, I would say. This is something people, cinephiles, whisper about, you know, like...
It's sort of, like, it sounds like the butt of a joke when you say, a 7.5-hour long black and white Hungarian film, like, it's like the punchline to a joke about art house cinema.
Right? Oh, I've made that joke. Yes.
I think maybe its reputation's kind of... been bolstered by that, like, it sounds like just such an outrageous thing until you actually sit down and watch it.
Yeah.
Or maybe after you sit down and watch it too, I don't know.
Yes. It's all that and more. But yeah, I'm in agreement with both of you, especially given its company. Metropolis and Jean Dielman are staggering works, I think. No question about their significance. What's that?
They're doozies.
Yes, they certainly are.
Very good.
Yes. especially the more I think about Jean Dielman, the more impressed I am. And in some ways, they share some similarities. They're both very slow. Not a lot happens. But I'm more and more impressed with Jean Dielman's structure, the way the repetition plays into the themes of the film. And that is a 3.5-hour long movie. That is a long movie, but it is not 7.5 hours. Yeah. the indulgence here, it just does not need to be that long.
I don't know, though. The one article I mentioned, the Vice article about this, one of the points that it makes is that as an adaptation of a novel, he thinks that it's maybe the best adaptation of a novel ever, that, you know, he quotes one particular section that is completely unfilmable as far as like describing the sounds and the texture of the walls and all these things, and the things that are going on in the character in Irmish and Petrina's head when they are sitting there waiting to go and meet with the guy for the summons at the beginning. And he's like, he quotes the passage and says, there's no way you can really film that except to sit there. You can't, what are you going to do? Do a montage of these guys sitting and waiting and cut it down to a 1-minute thing? No, you sit there and you sit there with the characters for 10 minutes mm-hmm. sitting there waiting.
Sure.
And
yep.
And you write the novel in your head as you're sitting there watching it.
I agree. Like, I don't think the length is the weak point. I think mm-hmm. it's sort of maybe just how certain aspects of the material
right.
translate to film, maybe. Or maybe its weakness might be more in its themes. I think, like,
right.
it's okay to have a film this long if it sort of sustains your attention and moves at a certain cadence.
Right,
like,
right.
You no, know, I yeah. love, like, Todd Haynes' Mildred Pierce adaptation that's probably close to the same length.
That is, yeah, that's true.
You know,
very
I,
true.
I think that's
no,
also
yeah.
a great literary translation, you know, or
yeah.
I guess probably Berlin Alexanderplatz is another one that you might
sure.
look at similarly.
Sure.
And I think maybe if Satan Tango were released as a miniseries in like 3 chunks or 12 episodes or something like that, I think maybe people might not point to the length as being the film's major flaw. Just
sure.
I
no,
the,
I mean,
the conversations
yeah.
about it would be pretty different. Yeah.
Sure. No, I mean, I guess my problem is not the length. My problem is that it is 7.5 hours and it doesn't feel coherent.
Right.
It's stylistically very coherent, but thematically, I'm still not exactly sure what he's trying to say. Mm. And that is a long time to sit there when you are uncertain of the author's voice. And indeed, it's a long time without knowing the intent of the film, the exact intent of the film, but knowing that it is a deeply misanthropic film. And that is difficult. That is where the difficulty lies, I think, for me. And again, I'll keep going back to Jean Dielman because it's my current obsession, I guess. But that is a bleak film. It is about the sadness of individuals, of an individual, but it isn't patronizing in the way that this one is. And I think that is ultimately where I had a lot of trouble with the film. Yeah. Did we, anything else?
I mean, what else is there to say?
What else is there to say? All right. So I'm going to go ahead and say I would put this significantly lower on the list. Significantly. I don't think this deserves to be in the top 100. Personally. But it's not a bad film. It is not a bad film. It is, I think it's worth seeing. If only so you can say you've seen it. And it's haunting. And there are some things that it does so, so right.
Mm-hmm.
And then there are other things that are a little bit unclear and that deserve more clarity. And we will come back to Bellatar because he, as we've mentioned, he appears on the list a couple more times. So I think in this case, we're going to have to demote him a little and for this film. We're going to demote not him, but the film.
Sorry. official.
Lady P has spoken.
I need a gavel or something. all right. Phew. We did it, guys. Now how about a little palate cleanser? Martin, what's one movie, television show, website, article, book, etc. that you've been digging lately?
Actually, there's a web series I was just rewatching called Catherine with Jenny Slate.
Ah.
People might know from Obvious Child and various comedy things.
Yes.
It's a little anxiety-inducing, but it's also very funny.
Okay.
it's good.
It's good. Yeah. Is it Jenny Slate doing her Jenny Slate thing?
Kind of. I think it's like almost a little bit like in Twin Peaks when they're kind of just acting wrong and it's a little bit troubling, but also funny.
Okay. I'm sold. Okay. Tad, how about you?
I have been getting into the singer Andra Day lately. I got to actually work with her recording some stuff for a cross promotional thing she's doing with Beats by Dre. Hadn't heard anything about her. She was super nice to work with. I heard her music and I was like, this is great. It's like very, it's like kind of Amy Winehouse-ish, but with like, you know, Billie Holiday, Nina Simone, Ella Fitzgerald influences. It's a great story about how she's discovered by Stevie Wonder. And I was like, oh, this is great. And then the next day I get on a plane to go on a trip for a shoot, and it's like featured artist, Andra Day, you know, music video by Spike Lee. I'm like, okay, she's not as like unknown as I thought, because I had never heard her name before the other day, but I just kind of fell in love with her music. So that's what I'm into a little bit lately.
Dig it. Dig it. Yep. So mainstream, Ted. Yeah. You knew her before she was famous.
The day before. Yeah.
Mine is, we're doing a little log rolling here, I think is the term, but there's another podcast that I don't believe I mentioned on the show called Criterion Close-Up, which is our friends, Aaron West and Mark Hearn, and with occasional appearances by our very own Martin Kessler, they are going through the Criterion catalog and talking about it. And so, you know, if that's your thing, which if you listen to this show, I would venture to guess it might be. Just a shot in the dark. You might want to check that one out. And of course, Aaron and Mark are great guys, and we try and support each other when we can. Also, I recently stumbled upon a new podcast called Auteur Museum, and it's put together by someone, a guy named Zach Lewis. There aren't a lot of episodes yet, but it seems like it's each episode goes into an in-depth analysis of one specific director, and they go through the entire filmography and talk about their style, and seems like it might also just investigate or sort of pick apart the auteur theory and what that means. I love that stuff. So, yeah, and also just generally, if people have movie podcasts or just really cool podcasts in general that they want to steer me to, I'm always grateful to hear that. So by all means, let me know. And that's the way we frame it, flicks-wise, that is. Listeners, have you seen Satan Tango? Come tell us about your experience on our website, flickswise.com, or you can join our collective on Facebook at facebook.com/flickswise. And I promise to lead you to the promised land if you follow me on Twitter. The handle is @flickswise. But before you do all of that, please rate us and leave us a comment on iTunes. And in return, I promise to write only nice things about you when I sell you out to the government. Huh? But seriously, please leave us a nice comment. It would really just make me really happy. Yeah, give meaning to my life, please, won't you? Okay, and speaking of giving meaning to my life, our next show is probably our biggest and most exciting yet. We have an entire hour devoted to the 39th entry in the Sight and Sound list, François Truffaut's Le Quatre Cent Coups. I got that down, right? Huh? Not bad. some people know it as The 400 Blows. And I am very pleased to announce that joining me for that episode is not only the renowned film scholar Joseph McBride, but also the lovely and talented daughter of François Truffaut, Miss Laura Truffaut.
Wow.
Ah, yay!
Very cool.
Yes. Yeah. I try not to be too hyperbolic. Me? Hyperbolic? No. when talking about the podcast, but you do not want to miss this one because it's going to be an awesome one. And that's very exciting. And I plan to release that one on November 16th. The anniversary of the 400 Blows U.S. release. And that's a Monday, which is a day ahead of when I usually release these things, but that just means you get it a day early. Until then, Martin, thank you so much for coming on the show and talking Satan Tango with me.
That was my pleasure.
Ted, 7.5 hours. You did it.
Yes. Again.
Again. Well, thank you for finding the time. and it's always a pleasure to have you on.
I am just wondering when you're going to have me back.
We'll have to arrange something. Okay. Yeah, until then, I guess there's nothing to do but keep trudging.
Plodding.
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 Poor cat.
Plodding.
Poor cat.
Poor cat. Poor kitty. Plodding. Plodding.